Well, good morning. Welcome to each and every one of you. I'd like to start out this morning. I want to share an excerpt from a speech I found very powerful. This is a speech that Teddy Roosevelt gave in Paris, France, in April of 1910. This speech, sometimes referred to the man in the arena, you may have heard it. I think it's very inspiring. It is not the critic who counts. Not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds? Who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions? Who spends himself in a worthy cause? Who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement? And who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails daring greatly? At least fails daring greatly. I don't know about you, but I found that very inspiring. I love the words daring greatly. It's the title of this book. And I think that this idea of daring greatly fits in well with our theme for this year. You know, we've talked about wanting for our ministry and for ourselves to realize expanding possibilities. You know, we want to have broader horizons. We want to reach for more. And daring greatly seems to fit well in that idea. This book, Daring Greatly, is written by a woman named Brené Brown. Anybody read any of her stuff? A couple people have. I only began hearing about her, I'd say, like in this last year. I've heard how wonderful she is and was curious. I saw a TED Talk that she had done. And then I also got to see her on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday. She's really a good speaker. She's from Texas, and so she has little witticisms and little sayings from Texas that are if you've lived in Texas, you recognize them. They're funny, but she's interesting and really down to earth, very understandable. So I like her writing. I like the way she speaks. She is Texan, and I think it's funny because she described in here that she was I believe, a fifth-generation Texan. Anybody in here from Texas? One, okay. When I was down there serving, we did something, you know, early on in my days there at the Irving Church, and I asked where people were from, never expecting people to say how many generations of Texan they were. You know, it's just, I've never even thought about saying I'm, you know, third generation Illinoisan, but it's a different culture. They're proud of their state. They're proud to be from there, and she's no different. Fascinating woman. She used to work at AT&T. Maybe another reason I felt some affinity with her. She worked at AT&T, was in middle management, and decided to leave and go back to school. And she did. She got she wanted to help people. She wanted to help them fix their problems. She got a bachelor's and a master's in social work, and it was at the end of her the master's program that she realized that social work was about being with clients and leaning into the challenges with them and helping them uncover their stuff, their solutions and their issues, the being naked thing, you know, hiding behind your garbage idea. We all have those kinds of things. So she says that she does a really good job of research, and then to do this work with clients is a little messier than she had intended. But she heard somebody talk about research and so she went. That's what she decided to do. So she was heavy into research. She got a PhD, and wanting to understand and do a lot of research about people and what the problems, the how do they get there, how do they find their solutions. What she came across was shame, and she began to do a lot of research on shame. Shame and empathy. So you'll hear, if you hear Brené Brown, often it's in the context of shame, empathy, and so forth. In that research, she said that she realized that connection is why we're here. That our relationships with people are what make our lives meaningful. It isn't about the things, it isn't about the stuff that we can't take with us when we die. It's about connection. It's about the relationship. I'm just going to share something with you. She says here, connection is why we're here. We are hardwired to connect with others. It's what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. And without it, there is suffering. So she believes very strongly that that's what it's about. It was funny to watch, and I've got a little clip that, if it fits in well, I would like to show you. It's an animated clip that she did on blame. We'll look at it next week. But as she was doing all this, she has a couple of other books that she's written before this one. One of them is called The Gifts of Imperfection. And she lists them in here. There are 10. To realize, you know, authenticity, you need to release such and such. So she has those 10 gifts listed in this forerunner of this book. And she says then that what happened was that she assessed herself after that book. Out of those 10, only 2 was she able to say about herself that she had achieved or had made much progress on. The other 8, not so much. You know? And it caused, when she writes, breakdown and puts a line through it, and then she has spiritual awakening. My breakdown, no, spiritual awakening. So it was a realization that she needed to go further. She needed to look at this stuff. And what she calls what we want to be is wholeheartedness. Wholeheartedness. To have that, she's discovered that we need to be something called vulnerable. Vulnerable. Vulnerability. She says that this wholeheartedness, there are 5 ideals that come from it. I'll share that with you. First one is that love and belonging are needs. So the ideals of this wholeheartedness, we accept that love and belonging are needed. That also goes along with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, for self-actualization. The second ideal is that we are worthy of love. We can kind of ask ourselves some of these questions as we go along. Are we wholehearted? Do we have this wholeheartedness? Yeah. The third is that wholehearted men and women want to live with courage, compassion, and connection. Ask yourself, do you want to live with courage, compassion, and connection? Yeah, I do. And then the idea is realizing that the 5th one is that vulnerability is a catalyst to having those 3 things. Courage, compassion, and connection. So all of this is building up to daring greatly. Being able to be in this world and daring greatly. Being willing to be vulnerable to do that. So the first topic that she takes on is scarcity. We have talked about scarcity before. When we did our prosperity class last fall, we talked about scarcity. And scarcity she defines as never enough. Never enough. Ever felt like that? Never enough. And she references. There, 21. Do you remember the book, The Soul of Money by Lynn Twist? Yes. Lynn Twist wrote about scarcity, and she called it the big lie. Here's what she says. For me and for many of us, our first waking thought of the day is, I didn't get enough sleep. The next one is, I don't have enough time. Whether true or not, that thought of not enough occurs to us automatically before we even think to question or examine it. We spend most of the hours and the days of our lives hearing, explaining, complaining, or worrying about what we don't have enough of. Before we even sit up in bed, before our feet touch the floor, we're already inadequate, already behind, already losing, already lacking something. And by the time we go to bed at night, our minds were racing with a litany of what we didn't get done, what we didn't get that day. We go to sleep burdened by those thoughts and wake up to that reverie of lack. This internal condition of scarcity, this mindset of scarcity, lives at the very heart of our jealousies, our greed, our prejudice, and our arguments with life. How can we switch, you know, if we're even waking up feeling like we don't have enough of something already? She goes on and talks about how these feelings thrive in a culture of shame. Shame is a whole lot more prevalent, I think, than we think. Listen to some of these questions. Is fear of ridicule and belittling used to manage people and or to keep people in line? You ever heard that happen or seen that happen? Is self-worth tied to achievement, productivity, or compliance? Are blaming and finger-pointing norms? Are put-downs and name-calling rampant? Yes, I think so. And when we think about our lives, when we think about the possibility of being ridiculed, particularly by people we care about, or our teachers, or our bosses, that's a pretty important fear. Fear of being shamed. Comparison is the second component. These are the three components of scarcity. So the first one is shame. The second is comparison. And I don't know any surer way to drive oneself nuts than to take a look at what you are or what you have and compare it to somebody else. Because there will always be someone else who has more than we do, always be someone who has less than we do, always the comparison will just drive you nuts. So comparison is another component. She says in here, healthy competition can be beneficial, but is there constant overt or covert comparing and ranking? Has creativity been suffocated? Shame and comparison. The third, and I think this one is probably the most dangerous for component of scarcity, and is disengagement. Are people afraid to take risks or try new things? Is it easier to stay quiet than to share stories? Let me say that again. Is it easier to stay quiet than to share stories? Part of what we're going to be doing this afternoon is beginning to share, you know, continuing to begin to share stories. It takes courage to do that. It takes courage because we don't want to be rejected. We don't want to feel shamed and so on. Disengagement. Does it feel as if no one is really paying attention or listening? Is everyone struggling to be seen and heard? So these components of scarcity, I see lots of evidence of those in our society, in our world today. Well, if we want to do something about it, if we want to challenge that, if we want to live in wholeheartedness ways, what would we do? Well, first we want to challenge these ideas of scarcity. So what would be the opposite? You might think at first that it would be abundance, but she says no, that's actually just the other side of the same coin, not enough or too much. But rather, the idea is that the opposite is enough. It is enough. She says if we go back to those three sets of questions that we just talked about, Ask yourself if you'd be willing to be vulnerable and to dare greatly in any setting defined by these values. For most of us, the answer is going to be a resounding no. If we're going to go out into the world and risk shame, being compared, or being disengaged, probably no. She says, not like this, the greatest casualties of a scarcity culture are our willingness to own our vulnerabilities, and second, our ability to engage with the world from a place of worthiness. Those are the things that go by the wayside if we fall into that scarcity model. So that's her first chapter. The second chapter, she goes into vulnerability myths. And she has four that she talks about. The first one is to the effect that vulnerability is a weakness. If we are willing to step up and be seen and be heard, stand up for what we believe in, we make ourselves vulnerable. But people sometimes think that's a weakness. We don't want to, there's even a commercial, never let them see you sweat. Right? You're supposed to keep that stiff upper lip and always act like you're in control. Put up a facade, in other words, that may not really be us. She had an interesting way of looking at this. She said that most of us value seeing vulnerability in other people. For people who are willing to get up on a stage and perform, to sing or to dance where they don't normally do that. We like that. We appreciate that. We applaud that. We think that they're courageous. But then when we think about doing it ourselves, well, no, you know, not me. So we appreciate vulnerability and see it as courage in others, but we don't want to do it for ourselves, and we see it as a disadvantage in ourselves, possibly a weakness. So vulnerability is a weakness is one myth that is not true. The second is what she calls, I don't do vulnerability. So the people who are walking around acting like they've got it all together and they're not going to show that side of themselves. She said that academic researchers are talking about herself, that they kind of pride themselves on being very standoffish, cool, reserved, you know. But she says that it isn't true that anybody can just, I don't do vulnerability, because in the choice of not being vulnerable, we're being something. We're being inauthentic. We're being reserved. We're being standoffish. And it shows up. People know. They can tell. They can tell. The third myth, letting it all hang out. Have you ever gone to some event or occasion, a meeting or anything, and somebody that you don't know blurts out something that is just too personal, and you think, whoa, too much information, too fast? You ever had that? Yes, yeah. I remember a class I was attending back in graduate school, actually, and it was for group therapy, so the first 2 hours would be class, traditional class, and the second 2 hours were a group. We had our own group for group therapy. So we were sitting around, and the first hour went by, and people were sharing kind of casually, and then we got maybe 30, 40 minutes into the second hour, so getting close to time to leave, and one of the members blurts out this really personal, deep, private issue that made her start crying, and the rest of us are just... being vulnerable isn't that. It isn't what she calls oversharing, and being on the other, being on the side of someone who is listening to someone oversharing, it's very uncomfortable. It doesn't feel right, and we don't want to be that person either. What she describes is if you are vulnerable, is that there's a process that takes place, and you check with yourself to see. Who has my back? Who listens to me? Who takes care of filling me in if I've missed a meeting? Who takes care of bringing my homework if I've missed a day? And who are those people then those would be the one you might start sharing something personal with. You know, and if that works well, they also share back. It's a process of deepening and trusting. Trusting is a big thing. So being vulnerable is not about spilling your guts to anybody and everybody. That's not what it is. And the last myth that she talks about is we can do it alone. Boy, is our society just rich in this kind of idea that I don't need any help. I can do it. And I've fallen prey to that kind of thinking myself, that it's strong to be capable and independent and do things on your own. To some degree, yes, but we cannot be vulnerable, really vulnerable, all alone. I think those of us here in this room tend to be more willing to be vulnerable with each other because you especially, I'm getting to know you and I'm willing to be vulnerable. But as we spend time together and as you guys have come up together, this is a safe place. We need the support of each other if we're going to be vulnerable. As we stay this afternoon and go through this session from 12 to 2 on being vulnerable and listen and share our stories as we go through this sacred conversations on race, we can do it because we're here with church family, church community. It'd be a whole different thing, I think, to go to and be with a whole bunch of strangers. We need support. We need each other. We need our family. She says that if she didn't have Steve, her husband, and her therapist, and she's got a hilarious exchange that she describes about being with her therapist, if she didn't have them, she would not have been able to get through all that she needed to get through to write this book, because she had to keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. Okay, so daring greatly. We want to do this. I think we do. You want to do this? Yeah? Okay. And we want to be more wholehearted. We want to be more willing to try this vulnerability thing. And you might be asking yourself, well, now why are we even talking about this? Why, this is church. Is this just a self-help group? No. Yes, I mean, we're trying to help ourselves. We're trying to get some ideas on how we can do that, but why? We do that because from the unity perspective, we each and every one of us have a power within us. We have a self, our Christ self, we call it, our higher self that is there waiting and ready to be expanded, to be magnified and intensified. And it is whole and it is pure. And the more we can do these kinds of things, the better we can express who and what we are, the truth of our being. Jesus had lots of instructions for us. We use Jesus as our master teacher, our way shower. We use the scripture to find places where he said, how are we supposed to be? And it's in there. Sermon on the Mount in Matthew gives us lots of direction on how we're to be. There's one that came to mind as I was putting this together. There's a scripture that talks about if you come to the altar to worship and you see a speck in your neighbor's eye, go away and get rid of the log that's in your own eye and then come back. So it's about taking care of our own stuff. This daring greatly, this idea of being vulnerable, this work at trying to be authentic and real and open is about trying to be the Christ. We'll continue this work. We'll have 3 more weeks of this. Next week, we're going to look in more depth and more detail on shame and how we can identify it, maybe recognize it. Let's take this opportunity to connect with our Maker, to find that place within ourselves, to find that power, that higher self, that Christ self. So as we do each week, I invite you to gently close your outer eyes and to relax. In this moment, we let ourselves become completely still in our bodies and as best we can in our minds. Our minds like to chatter, but here and now we turn that mind and let it focus on our breathing. So we pay attention to how it feels to have our breath coming in and how it feels to have it released. We breathe in and breathe out. If and as we deepen and slow our breath, our bodies naturally respond by relaxing even more. And so we continue to do that. We continue to breathe, continue to relax. We continue becoming more and more still. For it is in the stillness that we begin to get a sense of our true selves. We begin to get a sense that who and what we are isn't about what we have on our bodies, the clothes that we're wearing, the houses we live in, the cars that we drive. Who and what we are, we experience in the stillness. We feel that connection. We feel that presence. Often we'll feel it as peace. Because as we become very quiet and still and relaxed, that stillness translates then into receptivity. A willingness to be used, as the song said. We come open, willing to experience again that peace, that presence, that power. Often, if we are troubled, if we've had a really tough week, if we're having problems in a relationship or in a work situation, when we become still and relaxed, we'll find ourselves experiencing those emotions dissolving. We come, and in this openness, this connection, we find ourselves comforted. That peace seems to soothe and restore our hearts and our minds. In the stillness, we feel that which we are made up of, which is love. This is our true nature, our true beingness. And this love reaches out and touches others. We experience that when it is reciprocal. But the love is already there. It is always there. And this love that is us, that is God in us, is the love that allows us to move forward in our lives today and this week and going forward always in faith, In trust. This love lets us know that we are never alone. This love nourishes us and sustains us, fills all the cracks and crevices that we have happened during the week. It makes us whole. And so as we do each week, let us set aside some time in stillness, in silence, to feel that presence, that power, to feel and experience the peace, to feel, experience, and to be that love in the silence. And we are grateful. We are grateful that we are aware of this indwelling power. We are grateful that we can lean into that anytime and every time we need that support. We are grateful for all of the ways that we are supported by our family, by our church family, by our friends. We are grateful for all the many blessings, the lessons that become blessings, all the good that is here now and that is on its way. And so in that gratitude and in the love that we know to be our true selves, let us join together to repeat the words that our way-shower taught us as we say the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And leave us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.